Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Controversy about the origin of human beings continues to rage, even today, nearly 160 years after the publication of Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species. School districts have attempted, with varying degrees of legal success, to force teachers to teach students that the Darwinian evolutionary explanation for the origin of life is just one of many theories. Advocates of the creationism perspective, and to some degree the newer intelligent design perspective, continue to argue that the biblical story of creation, in which God created humans in their present form on the sixth day of creation, is as viable and as valid as the evolutionary perspective. Scientists largely assume that the argument should be over, and that the evolutionary explanation is so well established by scientific evidence that there is no longer any room for debate. Americans in general, according to a number of polls, are not so quick to agree with the preponderance of scientific evidence. My guest, coming up next, Jeffrey K. Lyons, is here to challenge evolution. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Jeffrey K. Lyons, Ph.D., is a graduate of University of Hawaii at Manoa and Regent University, where he earned a Ph.D. in communications. He's taught at Hawaii Pacific University, Argosy University, Honolulu, and Honolulu Community College. He's published articles in the Global Media Journal, Journal of Radio and Audio Media, and the Hawaiian Journal of History. He is the author of Evolution Myths, A Critical View of Neo-Darwinism. Hey, Jeffrey, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Hey, great being here. Did you mention Hawaii Pacific University? I also taught there.
Ah, I missed that one. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you for the update on the resume.
No problem. Yeah. So I loved your introduction at the top, and you mentioned that, of course, Darwin's book came out about 160 years ago, and many people say, you know, what's the point of criticizing it? It's established science. So I just kind of want to put a teaser out to your audience. There's a very important book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And it was written by Thomas Kuhn. And the book's been out for 50 years. But Kuhn is the person that came up with the word paradigm. You've probably heard that term before, paradigm.
Oh, yes.
And what he was referring to is that science works in agreement, and then when somebody comes up with something that's completely different, scientists shift. A great example of that is Newton. When came out with all his formulas and talked about gravity, and so we talk about Newtonian physics. It was a scientific revolution. But the point I'm trying to make is, and Kuhn documents this over centuries of scientific research. It's probably one of the greatest books of the 20th century, Structure of Scientific Revolutions. The point of it is that scientists never agree with each other. And so when people say that evolution, everybody agrees, well, that's just not the case. And that's what we'll be talking about over the next couple hours, because I've got source after source after source, and these are not church people or people that are looking at evolution from a metaphysical point of view. These are scientists and atheists, and people are constantly questioning evolution, and that's normal. That's what every scientist should do. So I just kind of put that out there, is that whenever you hear all scientists agree, there's kind of a red flag on the field right there, because scientists do not agree with each other. And if you go to scientific,
right, and
if you go to conferences, and I've been to conferences, what they do is they present papers and they disagree with each other. They do it all the time.
Right. It's never been about science. Has never been about consensus. Let me ask you some. I'm going to play the part of a critic here, They'll say, well, Jeffrey K. Lyons, well-spoken, a good writer, he's an academic, but his PhD is in communications. He's not a biologist, he's not a physicist, he's not a chemist. How is he qualified to try and poke holes in evolution or neo-Darwinism? How do you respond?
Excellent question, and I get that all the time. So the way I would respond is that evolution, even though there's a lot of experimentation going on, there's obviously science happening in terms of under the microscope and mapping DNA, so on and so forth. But the larger picture of evolution is, quite frankly, it's not science at all. Karl Popper, the philosopher, said that that evolution is not scientific at all. He said it's a metaphysical research project. In other words, it can't be proven empirically. Let me give you two real good examples. Let me put the question out there. If I say, can a boulder, play Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, what would you say?
I would say that's true.
You would say that?
You asked me about Beethoven? I'm sorry, did you say Beethoven composed the Fifth Symphony?
No. I said, can a rock, just a rock.
Oh, can a rock.
On the ground, can it?
I'm sorry, I thought you said Beethoven. I misunderstood.
Yeah,
I would say probably not. No, I would argue
probably
against a rock.
Well, that's the argument of evolution. You take a rock the size of the Earth, you put it in the solar system, you have it rotating around the sun, and you wait billions of years. And after enough time, you're going to hear Beethoven's symphony coming out of it. So the only thing that changed is time. But if I said, hey, Richard, you know, let's put a rock in your living room and let's observe it for a few hours and see if we're going to hear Beethoven's symphony come out of it. Well, you're going to say, well, that's absurd. That's ridiculous. Let me give you another quick example, because my point is that evolution is storytelling. It's not in the bigger picture. It's not science. I'm a Mayflower descendant, okay? Now, if I told you, Richard, if I just said, hey, I'm a descendant of John Howland, who was on the Mayflower, what would your natural response be to that?
Wow, I would say that, what are the odds, you know?
Yeah, you'd say, what are the odds? And you might ask, well, how do you know that? And if I just said, well, my mother told me, well, then you might think, okay. But that's not very convincing. But then if I told you, well, I researched it for over a year, and I have all the birth certificates going back 400 years, and I got certified by the Mayflower Society, which is in Plymouth, that would be a bit more convincing, wouldn't it?
Yes, now you're starting to compile some documentation and some hard data.
Exactly. So here's what evolution they're trying to tell you. They're trying to tell you that they have the proof of every generation from you and me going back to the very first life that existed 3.5, 3.7 billion years ago. And here's my response, Richard. Where's the birth certificates?
Right, right. Okay. You know, interesting point. Interesting point.
Where's the birth certificates? I mean, if I say I'm a Mayflower descendant, you're going to say, where's the birth certificates going back to Howland? I produced them, and I was certified. But nobody can come up with the birth certificates going back 3.7 billion years. It's not only is it absurd, it's just ridiculous. So all they have is storytelling, trying to connect the dots. And we can get into more details.
I wanted to start with a couple of
holes in their story. Yeah. So that, I mean,
I wanted to start with a couple of definite.
Yeah, that's why I can criticize it, because as someone who studies communication, that's right in my field, rhetoric.
All right. So I want to start with some definitions, if we could. Differentiate microevolution and macroevolution.
Absolutely. Microevolution would be evolution on a small scale, micro. And so, you know, we look at Darwin and the finches that he observed at the Galapagos. They had different beaks, but they were all finches. We look at modern dogs. They're all dogs. Modern cats, they're all cats. So that's microevolution. And it happens all the time, and it's normal. And in fact, they've been able to document, you know, through breeding, you know, different types of dogs, like the Rottweiler, which was bred to pull milk carts in Germany.
Okay, so are we talking, when we're talking micro, would that include things like adaptation and natural selection?
It could. It could on a small scale. Sure, yeah.
And do you have any problem? You have no problem with that?
No, I don't have any problem with that because, look, every year they have to come out with a new flu shot because the flu virus is changing all the time. So that happens all the time. But the problem is with macroevolution. You know, if you're going to tell me that I'm the descendant from bacteria that showed up 3.7 billion years ago, I'm going to say, I got a problem with that. Where's the birth certificates? That just doesn't make any sense at all. And there's all kinds of holes in that story, going back to single-cell creatures, prokaryotes, eukaryotes. We can get into it. Problems with chirality, amino acids. I'm just throwing out some terms, but those are teasers, and we can get more in-depth on those things.
So one of the arguments is that, you know, according to the scientific method, you can't reproduce it in a lab, you can't see it happening. You can't observe evolution. But so the counter argument to that has often been, well, you can actually observe humans evolving. One of the more common examples would be, let's say, 2,000 years ago, most humans couldn't consume milk past the age of 5. The majority of everyone's production of what is that called? Lactase?
Lactose,
this enzyme that allows us to that allows us to digest the lactose found in milk. But now, 2,000 years later, adults can drink milk. So we are evolving. We can observe us evolving.
Absolutely. But that's a perfect example. But let's see. You said going back how many years?
I think it was around 2,000 years ago. The scientists say before that adults couldn't digest milk properly.
Okay, so let's just for the sake of argument say there was documentation going back 2,000 years ago. But the fact is, humans are still humans. They haven't changed. The humans haven't turned into sheep or cats or chickens. They're still humans. So that's still microevolution. It's not macroevolution, and I don't have any problem with that. It's really not an issue.
Right. So again, that would speak to more to adaptation and natural selection. So let's go to another major point here in terms of arguing against macroevolution then. And you talk about the fact that there's no evidence for abiogenesis, which is the spontaneous generation of life. In other words, life always begets life, we're told, except in the beginning when non-life produced life, abiogenesis. You're saying there's no evidence for that. In fact, it's been disproven. Just expand on that.
Oh, yeah, it's been disproven. Of course, at first it was called spontaneous generation of life, and before they came up with the fancy term abiogenesis, and that was because they saw maggots on meat that had been left out, and so, hey, the maggots spontaneously generated, well, flies came by and landed on it, and eggs were implanted in the meat, and So that's how that happened. But Pasteur, Louis Pasteur, who we get the word pasteurizations from, very, very famous chemist, maybe the most famous chemist that's ever lived, he won the Paris Academy of Sciences back in 1862, recognition for disproving spontaneous generation of life. And what he did was he put broth in a vial, and actually the vial was not sealed off to the exterior environment. It was it had a curve or an S shape. So if anything fell, which you couldn't see by gravity, microbes, it would be caught in the S shape. And what happened was, and it was distilled water or broth, and nothing happened. It didn't change. But then he cut the top off, and then it did change because microbes in the air fell on it. It was a very clever experiment, and, you know, the listener can look it up. But basically, he disproved spontaneous generation of life. Abiogenesis is just a fancier term for the same thing. And you and I know we're alive. I assume we know we're alive. So the question is always, how did we get here? And as you search the literature, there are theories, but all they are is stories. And they have no idea. Here's one of my favorite stories, and this is why communication scholars should look at this. National Academy of Sciences, Institute of Medicine, from a book called Science, Evolution, and Creationism. Very easy to look up. Here's their story of how life came about. Nobody knows which combination of molecules first met these conditions. Researchers have shown how the process might have worked. Studying a molecule called RNA. Researchers recently discovered that some RNA molecules can greatly increase the rate of specific chemical reaction. Then it goes on, it says, if a molecule like RNA could reproduce, perhaps with assistance of molecules, it could form the basis. If such replication were packaged, they might have formed protocells. Molecules could... It doesn't sound very convincing, does it? I mean, it's riddled with words like might, some, if, perhaps, could, might have. They don't know. They absolutely don't know. It's like a prosecutor at a trial saying to the jury, well, Mr. Jones might have done the crime if he was in the room. Well, he could have had the gun. But maybe he had the gun. Well, he could be guilty. Well, he might be the person who's guilty of this crime. I mean, if you were in the jury, would you convict Mr. Jones of that?
No, it's not a very good legal argument, is it? But we're coming up on a break here.
And this is the National Academy of Sciences, Institute of Medicine. These are the smartest guys in our country that published this book, and they have no idea, absolutely no idea.
All right, we're gonna take a time out here, Jeffrey. When we come back, we'll get into some other aspects of. I want to talk to you about Darwin and whether he actually even used the term evolution and whether he liked the term evolution, and we'll also. Talk about, this is kind of interesting. I want you to explain what you mean by left-handed amino acids and what that has to do with this argument as well. Jeffrey K. Lyons, my guest. Welcome back. A team of researchers has discovered a mysterious stone formation beneath the Straits of Mackinac. That's the narrow waterway that separates Michigan's upper and lower peninsula. Known as Search Inc., the group, which is mostly made up of Native American tribal citizens, had begun using a remote-operated underwater vehicle to carry out a cultural assessment of oil and gas pipelines on the lake bed, when they came across what appeared to be an artificial stone formation. The find could have considerable significance, especially given that the last time this region was not completely underwater was likely 10,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age. We didn't expect to find this. It was really just amazing, said group member Andrea Pierce. He said, my question is, who knew they were there? You can read more of this story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. And be sure to tune in tonight, Sunday night, into Monday morning on Coast to Coast AM. George Knapp welcomes Brian Muraskew, who practices international law while maintaining an obsession with the mysterious spiritual foundations of Western civilization. Also, he's the founding executive director of Doctors for Cannabis Regulation, and he'll join George to discuss how he gained access to the hidden collections of the Louvre Museum and secret archives of the Vatican to unearth documents never before translated into English, unveiling the first hard data for the ritualistic use of psychedelic drugs in antiquity and the formation of religions. In the second half, pioneering planetary scientist Sarah Seeger searches for exoplanets, especially for distant elusive worlds that could sustain life. But with the unexpected death of her husband, the purpose of her own life became hard for her to see. And she'll speak about her struggles to navigate the loss and the solace found in the alien beauty of exoplanets and the technical challenges of their exploration. That's Sunday night into Monday morning with George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. All right, we will get back to my conversation with Jeffrey K. Lyons discussing neo-Darwinism and the case against evolution here on Coast to Coast AM. Jeffrey, we were talking earlier before the break about the, you know, the randomness, the seemingly randomness of the evolutionary process and the probabilities against it and so forth. And many of us will be familiar with this analogy, the idea of a typhoon blowing through a junkyard and constructing a Boeing 747. This was an argument that was made famous by, I think it was Fred Hoyle. But I was reading an article in New Scientist, or online, newscientist.com, and they're saying that a somewhat better analogy to the typhoon blowing through a junkyard and constructing a Boeing 747, which is what the critics of evolution say, you know, that's how ridiculous that the randomness is. They're saying a better analogy would be starting with a million junkyards, painstakingly testing the wreckage left in each one after the tornado to find the most flight-worthy, making a million exact copies of that junkyard, unleashing another million tornadoes, running another series of exhaustive tests, and so on, until you produce some kind of machine, no matter how crude and un-Boeing 747-like, capable of flying at least a few yards. So, in other words, natural selection, it may appear random, but it's this rigorous testing process. It filters out what works from what doesn't, and it drives organisms to evolve in particular directions. You know, chance may play a role, but there is, you know, there is a process going on here. What do you say to that?
Well, there's a lot of things there that we can take apart. One of the as you know, Darwin wasn't he didn't have access to the microscopes and the electron microscope and all of this information that we have available today. He didn't know about prokaryotes. He didn't know about eukaryotes. He didn't know about amino acids. He didn't know about DNA. DNA was only discovered back in the 60s, Watson and Crick. And so there was so much that Darwin didn't know. He thought a cell was something simple. A cell is so complex that there's no human being on earth that can create it. I mean, you can take a cell, you can break it apart with a pin and a test tube, and then you can ask, hey, can you put it back together? Well, no one can put Humpty Dumpty back together. So, but that's oversimplified. The real problem is information. And Stephen Meyer and others talk about this, but DNA is a code. It's like software in a computer. And about 1% of the DNA in our cells tell the body how to make the proteins in our bodies. But the rest of the code, we don't even know what it is. But it controls everything going on in our body, all the different activities, the beating of the heart, so on and so forth, the blood flowing, everything. So the question is, who coded the code? If I were set to say, hey, Richard, I've got a computer, and I want to sell it to you. I'm going to sell it to you cheap, only $500. And you say, great, does it come with any software? And I go, no, it doesn't come with any software at all. Nobody's written any software for it, but, you know, maybe it'll work someday. Would you spend $500 for that computer?
Probably not.
And this is what they're trying to sell us. They're trying to sell us a story that life came about. Yeah, we know what the computer is like, the molecules and the chemicals and the physical information that we can weigh, and we know what's in the cell. We know what the chemicals are, so on and so forth. But the DNA, that's software. That's coded information. And it is so incredibly complex. Darwin had no idea what it was. And nobody has an idea who did the coding. That's the whole question right there. And that's why intelligent design is gaining so much ground, is because it clearly was designed. Now, intelligent design is not a creationist theory. It is agnostic as to who the creator is. It just says there's an intelligent.
Why can't they both be correct? Why can't an intelligent designer use evolution?
They can, but there's a continuum, because there's people that believe in intelligent design that don't believe in creation. In fact, Darwin himself believed in intelligent design. Most people don't realize that because they don't read Darwin's book. But the very last sentence of his book says, there's grandeur in this view of life with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, while this planet goes cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity. So simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful, most wonderful have been and are being evolved. That's the very last sentence of On the Origin of Species. All you have to do is go to the bookstore and pick it up. So Darwin talked about the Creator. Here's another one. Darwin said, to my mind, it accords better with what we know of the laws impressed on matter by the Creator, that the production, extinction of the past and present inhabitants of the world should have been due to secondary causes, so far. So Darwin did not dismiss the fact that life could have been started by a creator. He just didn't know who the creator was. Now, for the Christian, I happen to be a Christian myself. I believe there is a creator, and that the creator is very clearly described in the Bible. There are people of other faiths that believe the Creator is something else. I believe Christianity, Genesis, and that there's a Creator, and it's all explained in the book of Genesis. But one doesn't have to believe in a particular religion. One doesn't even have to be religious to be to believe in intelligent design. My other favorite example is Francis Crick, the very person who discovered DNA along with Watson. He also said that an honest man looking at the facts would declare that life is almost a miracle. And then what he discovered, and here's the thing, every chemist at every university in the entire world knows about chirality. But this is not taught by biologists. It's like biologists don't even talk to chemists. It's very interesting.
Okay, so what is chirality? What is this?
Chirality.
Yeah, what is chirality?
Great question. That's the teaser. So Have you ever put a corkscrew into a wine bottle and twisted
right.
it? Yeah. So you twist it, and you twist it to the right, usually. And then you take
Correct.
The cork out. If you twisted it to the left, it's not going to work. It's not going to go into the cork. It turns out that the amino acids, which are the building blocks of protein, okay, this is what Crick says in his book, and all these books are cited in my book, Evolution Myths, Critical View of Neo-Darwinism. But Crick wrote a book called Life Itself, Its Origin in Nature, and he says, most significantly, the small molecules that are strung together to make proteins, the amino acids, are all L amino acids. Then he says this, the first great unifying principle of biochemistry is that the key molecules have the same hand in all organisms. So what we find out is that at the molecular level, the amino acids, which are required to make proteins in every living thing on the face of the earth, they all twist to the left. Every single one.
Okay, they're left-handed. Left-handed amino acids. So why is that? What is that? Why is that significant? Why does that argue against evolution?
Why is that significant? Think of flipping a coin. The number of cells of every living thing on the face of the earth, and always getting heads. And then ask yourself, what is going on? Because if you or I sat in our living rooms and flipped a coin over and over, probability says we're going to get half heads and half tails. Crick was so bothered by this, and Crick is an atheist and a brilliant scientist, that Crick came to the conclusion that it's impossible for life to come about by chance on Earth. That was his conclusion. And so Crick said, well, it must have been panspermia. Must have been aliens put life on a spaceship and they shot it to Earth. Because Crick knew he was alive. He's not a Christian or a person of faith. He had to come up with some other explanation for something that he absolutely can't explain, which is a perfect symmetry. All life has left-handed molecules, and it makes absolutely no sense. Nobody's been able to explain this. You can ask any chemist at any university anywhere in the world, they all know this. It, for them, it's like no big deal. Yeah, I know that. But it's funny. The people in the chemistry department don't talk to the people in the biology department. So students are completely, this information is completely kept from the students.
So let's talk a little bit about, we've got about 4 minutes here before the break. We'll start the conversation now, continue it after the break. I want to talk about the change going from a single cell organism to multi-celled life, and why you say that that poses huge problems for the Darwinists.
Enormous problems. So single cell life, the earliest form of life they've found is called a prokaryote. And it's easy to remember if you think of P, puny, prokaryote. So P, puny. First of all, scientists had no idea how life came about. They don't know the software that created it. They can't put Humpty Dumpty back together. And they can't explain why every cell on every living thing on the face of the earth turns to the left. But the next change is from a cell to a cell with a nucleus. And all we can do is tease it right now, but the amount of change between bacteria, the oldest type of cells ever discovered on Earth, and a cell with a nucleus, which came a few million years later, more like a billion, there's no explanation. It's never been observed. There's theories out there, and we can go over some of those after the break, but again, they're just storytelling. It's never been observed.
Well, we've got about 3 minutes here, so let's talk about some of the attempts to explain from the evolution, I mean, what is their the evolutionary explanation for the creation of multicelled organisms? How do they say
Well,
it, how do they see it happened?
the common textbook explanation right now is Lynn Margulis's theory. And it comes under different names, symbiosis, endosymbiosis. But basically, the story, it's a story. It's not even observed. No one has seen this take place. The story is one little bacteria one day came along and it ate another bacteria. And then the two merged, and then bingo, you got a new cell called a eukaryote. A eukaryote. Easy to remember, eukaryote, enormous. Eukaryotes can be as much as 500 times larger than a prokaryote. The largest eukaryotes are even visible to the eye. Bacteria is not visible to the eye. But this has never been observed. It's only a theory. There's some interesting genetic research that's gone on to try and back it up. But I can get into more research on the other side of the break. Scientists aren't buying this story at all. But it's in all the science textbooks. It's in the college textbooks. And you'll see these cute little stories of one cell eating another and then creating the prokaryote. And suddenly a nucleus appears.
All right, we'll pick that up on the other side, and we'll also open up the phone lines at the bottom of the next hour and take questions and comments for Jeffrey K. Lyons, Evolution Myths, a Critical View of Neo-Darwinism, here on Coast to Coast AM.